You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Attitudes on gay rights have changed dramatically over the last few decades, as evidenced by President Obama's announcement in May that he now supports same-sex marriage, a position that would have been considered politically toxic just 8 years ago. Lawyer and professor Linda Hirschman has chronicled the entire political history of the gay rights movement in America in her book, Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution, How a Despised Minority Pushed Back, Beat Death, Found Love, and Changed America for Everyone. Since Professor Hirschman was here in June to talk about it, there have been even more changes in gay rights. Last month, voters approved legalizing same-sex marriage in Maine, Maryland, and Washington. And in its upcoming session, the Supreme Court will hear legal arguments for and against the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8. I began by asking Linda Hirschman, do you think America has reached a crossroads in social attitudes towards gays and lesbians?
Yes, I think America has reached crossed the line on that subject. I think that we now are at a place where it would be almost impossible to roll it back.
Although we have seen some setbacks, but you're calling your book Victory.
Right. And I don't mean by that we should put on a flak jacket and jump onto an aircraft carrier in front of a banner that says mission accomplished. There's a lot left to do.
Although there, just today, in fact, a short time ago, we're not even sure of the details, there was a major court ruling on Prop 8.
Well, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, the federal court in California, had been asked to rehear the victorious decision from the three-judge panel en banc, meaning with a bigger number of judges from the Ninth Circuit. They'd been asked to have more judges rehear it, and obviously, hopefully, the people asking for the appeal were hoping that the larger panel would reverse it. But the court just turned that down. They said the decision of the three-judge panel would stand. That decision was 2-1. In favor of same-sex marriage.
So we're talking about the court challenge to Proposition 8 in California led by Ted Olson and David Boies.
That's right.
So is it the next step of the Supreme Court?
Yeah, the Supreme Court would be the next step. And I actually have a theory that the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which took forever to make this decision not to rehear it, was delaying it until the First Circuit in Boston ruled, striking down as unconstitutional the Defense of Marriage Act. So at this point, the Prop 8 case won't go alone to the Supreme Court. It will either follow the First Circuit case or the two will go together.
This was in what they call an en banc decision, 11-judge panel.
Well, they decided not to rehear it.
But this is all seems to be part of a lot of stuff that's going on recently. President Obama claimed to be evolving on the issue of gay marriage, although in 1996 he announced his support for civil unions. Can you discuss some of the political circumstances surrounding his decision?
Actually, in 1996, he signed a document supporting same-sex marriage.
Same-sex marriage.
Right, not just
and then
civil
he said
unions.
He was for
right,
civil
and then
marriage.
He backtracked. So, and then he four-tracked. So first he was for it before he was against it before he was for it.
He was running for president after 1996.
Right. So it does make you at least question the sincerity of his commitments. But I think that the announcement that he made saying that he was in favor of same-sex marriage a couple weeks ago is really evidence of the victory of the movement. The movement achieved this. This was not something that Barack Obama handed them. They had made his life a living hell for the last several years as he agonizingly inched toward this position. They pressed him hard using every tactic that they have.
Well, the general feeling, conventional wisdom, is that Joe Biden forced his hand by declaring his support of same-sex marriage on Meet the Press. But do you think he would have done that without at least talking to the White House?
Well, I was on another program right after Obama announced, and the canny political operatives who were on the program with me, that doesn't include me, speculated unanimously that Joe Biden had simply overstepped in his clumsy way, and that it was not that the Obama administration had sent the flag up to see what would happen, that it was truly an accident. We'll never know. I think the more interesting thing to talk about, though, is how we got to a place where the president of the United States would be saying what he said.
Well, this is also interesting when you look at what's happened in the black community, because for many years people wanted to separate in the civil rights movement civil rights for minorities and civil rights for gays. And now the NAACP has come out in support of same-sex marriage. But we're still hearing a lot of objections from many members of the black clergy.
Right. The NAACP has been pretty good on that subject for a while. I actually give their leadership a lot of credit for supporting same-sex marriage for some years now. And I do think that they tried to help fight off Prop 8 in California. But I predicted after Obama spoke that it would not cost him in the black community. And I'm pleased to observe that, in fact, it looks like it has somewhat altered the hostility, such as there was, among African Americans to same-sex marriage.
Do you think that it was a win-win situation for him? Because most of the people who would be most outraged by what he said were already going to vote for somebody else.
Right. I think this was really about race. He needs this huge enthusiastic turnout in the African American community that he got in 2008, record-setting turnout. That's what he needs. And if there was any damper put on that, I think it would have cost him dearly.
But he also will get a lot of donations from the gay and lesbian community, won't he?
He was getting those anyway, for one thing. And for another thing, the vaunted gay TM, the great deep pockets of the gay community, are really pretty small, are pretty shallow. There just aren't that many gay people in America or out gay people in America. I mean, some closeted people may be giving him money. I don't know. But there just isn't that much money. So I would be surprised if he would make such a risky political decision based on his need for their donations.
Well, you mentioned earlier the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston finding the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, unconstitutional. How significant is that? We have a very conservative Supreme Court. If these two cases come to the Supreme Court and they decide to reverse both of these decisions, then what will it mean ultimately?
That would be terrible.
But it's possible.
It is certainly possible. I am very anxious about the current position of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's really the only justice that counts in that heavily divided court, because his decisions in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years have been much more conservative than they were before. I believe that Sandra Day O'Connor was the better angel of his nature, and when she left, his decisions got more conservative. So I'm worried about it. I am happy that the First Circuit case is going up, if not first, at least alongside the Prop 8 case, because I think the First Circuit case would allow the court to support same-sex marriage without going all the way to declaring it to be a constitutional right.
Well, what we're seeing is this being fought on two fronts, both in legislatures and in courts. Which is the better way?
You know, it's being fought on three fronts, at least, in the legislatures, in the courts, and in the court of public opinion, in the culture. That has been an enormously important part of the triumphant gay revolution, that they have actually changed people's hearts and minds. And so I think that all you need to use all those.
Well, it's changed partly because of the younger people seem to disagree with their parents and their grandparents on this. You cite the May 2011, a year ago, Gallup poll that showed that 53% of Americans believe gay marriage should be legalized. I suspect it may even be a little higher today.
That number fluctuates around 53%, 50%. I'm not sure that it's higher. It kind of bounces along that level. But that's a pretty high level considering the history that I chronicle in my book.
But then when it's brought to a vote, the latest case being North Carolina,
right.
The polls don't seem to be reflected in how the the voters decide.
The conventional wisdom on that is that people, a minority of people, care passionately to stop same-sex marriage, and they turn out in large numbers when it's put to a plebiscite, as it was in North Carolina. So if in the privacy of your own home, if the phone rings and a pollster asks you what you think, you're going to say you support it. But it's the people who oppose it who come to the polls. And that's a very important distinction. And it's very important that the gay revolution, if it's ultimately going to have a final victory, is to turn out people caring as passionately about it as the opponents do.
North Carolina's Amendment 1 also restricted the ability of straight people to enter domestic partnerships.
Right.
So there was a larger issue there.
You know, I have had for a long time the belief that the states of the old Confederacy are retrograde in a variety of social issues.
But North Carolina has always been seen as one of the more liberal of the southern states.
So it's like Henny Youngman's question, how's your wife compare to what? So the states of the old Confederacy voted unanimously to oppose women's suffrage when it was put up for amendment in 1920. So I think that they have suffered consistently over American history from being one whole social revolution behind the rest of the country.
My guest is Linda Hirschman, who's written a book called Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution, How a Despised Minority Pushed Back, Beat Death, Found Love, and Changed America for Everyone. It is published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in this hour, Joan Rivers talks about her latest book, I Hate Everyone, Starting With Me. And don't forget to check out our show page where you can find out about our book club, learn about what our guests are reading and watching, and see photos of guests in our studios. It's all on our show page at WNYC.org. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from the New York Philharmonic, performing Beethoven's Symphony No. 7 and Grieg's Piano Concerto, featuring Jean-Yves Thibaudet, Thursday through Saturday at Avery Fisher Hall. Tickets at 212-875-5656 or nyphil.org. Plaza Jewish Community Chapel, owned and operated by the Jewish community, located at 91st Street in Amsterdam, offering a full range of funeral services, including arrangements in advance. More information at plazajewishcommunitychapel.org. Adelphi University, offering classes and internship opportunities in many fields of education, with options for financial aid toward earning a degree. More information at adelphi.edu/success.
At WNYC, we'll always stand by you, giving you the facts when you need them most, breaking news that's sometimes tough to hear, connecting you to people across the city and around the world, bringing your voice into the mix. Because sometimes it's good to listen, and sometimes it's great to be heard. WNYC. Never turn it off.
We're back with an interview I did in June with Linda Hirschman, a lawyer, professor, and self-described pundit, and the author of Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution, How a Despised Minority Pushed Back, Beat Death, Found Love, and Changed America for Everyone. I asked her how the gay rights movement has benefited from the civil rights and feminist movements that came before it.
Well, I think from the feminist movement, they benefited enormously from the idea that sex roles were created by culture and politics and were not natural and immutable or biblical. I think that's the biggest thing that the feminist movement did for the gay revolution was to start to make the, you know, sex role behavior fuzzy at the edges and give people some breathing room. The racial civil rights movement is, I think, was enormously influential, as it was on every movement that followed the, let's say, the sit-ins in 1960. It was, even the decision in Brown in 1954 was enormously influential because it showed that you could challenge the governing elites in America, and they weakened, and that made room for other claims.
In all of those debates, there were biblical citations to argue against equal rights for minority groups and equal rights for women. And they were beaten down, but they seem to be still quite strong in this area. Why do you think that is?
you know, I think sinful is the last thing left. When the gay revolution started, homosexuals, as they were called then, were considered to be crazy. Their sexual acts were criminal. They were considered to be disloyal by the McCarthyites and sinful in the Bible. So I think that they have successfully fought three of those horsemen of the apocalypse, as I call them. And the sinful one is the one that's left. That is often the case because the gay revolution succeeded in the secular liberal state by invoking America's democratic principle.
But people on the left weren't always so much in support of gay rights. In fact, the communists sure weren't.
No, they
weren't. And even feminists, Betty Friedan, made comments about the Lavender Menace.
You know, it's something very few people know about communism and homosexuality, is that when the Bolshevik Revolution happened in Russia in 1917, in fact, when the Bolsheviks took over, they decriminalized homosexuality, which had been criminal under the religiously driven reign of the Tsar. So they were really, you know, progressive in the true sense of the word. It was Stalin that reinstated the criminality of homosexuality.
But then that continued into the later governments. Many years ago, when there was still a Soviet Union, I interviewed two reporters from TASS, and a caller called in and asked about the treatment of homosexuals in the Soviet Union. They said, no problem, there are no homosexuals in the Soviet Union.
There we go. You know, Stalin did not do anybody any favors. I bet you've already figured that out.
Well, what about Betty Friedan?
You know,
That was an old attitude. She wasn't alone.
No, she was not alone. And she was terribly mistaken. And I give the feminist movement a lot of credit for how quickly they walked away from that. I mean, it was not a year after she said that the radical lesbians had made an appearance at the Congress to unite women and wearing their T-shirts, take a lesbian to lunch. And the women at Betty Friedan's Congress embraced them and included them. And that was the right thing to do. Lesbian women suffered more than heterosexual women from the discrimination that the feminist movement addressed, because they had to work. They could not make a heterosexual bargain with a man without being really untrue to themselves and sacrificing a lot. So the discrimination against women hit them very hard. And I give the feminist movement a lot of credit for how quickly they abandoned Betty Friedan's position.
There have been several waves of the feminist movement. What characterizes the waves of the gay rights movement?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say that the current wave is the victorious wave of the gay revolution, because it really started around 1997, after the dying went down from 50,000 victims a year in 1996 to 15,000 victims a year in 1997. I mark that as the beginning of the current victorious phase of the gay revolution. The Supreme Court of the United States in 1996 issued the first really sweeping pro-gay ruling in the history of the republic, saying that gays and lesbians could go to their legislatures and get help, and that it was unconstitutional to say they could not. And that's a case called Romer versus Evans out of Colorado. So between Romer and the medicines for the AIDS epidemic, the movement kind of shook itself off and really started the final drive to victory that I believe we are going to see in my lifetime. Prior to that, I would say there was the AIDS period, there was the Stonewall period, there was the political period from 1950 on, and then there was the pre-political period.
Well, the AIDS period started off with a lot of homophobia.
Well,
when did it move from William Buckley saying we should tattoo the buttocks of homosexuals with warning labels to these people are terrible, are victims of a terrible disease?
You know, I think that Buckley was invoking a homophobia that goes much further back. You know, McCarthy made gays, not McCarthy, but the McCarthyites in Congress made gays their target. I mean, the homophobia goes way back before AIDS. AIDS just harnessed a pre-existing homophobia. But what the gay revolution did that was so brilliant is they fought it, and they fought it in two crucial ways. One was by behaving in the most caring, upright manner you could possibly imagine, taking care of one another and taking care of people who even were just like intravenous drug users and stuff and weren't even homosexual. So they made a moral stance that I think gained them a lot.
Although there was a split within the gay community, as Larry Kramer wrote about in his play, The Normal Heart.
And the second point is they embraced Larry Kramer's activism, as he expressed it in The Normal Heart, and more importantly in his landmark speech to the Gay and Lesbian Center in March of 1987. So they acted like they were citizens, like they were members of the social contract, and they were entitled to claim help from the government. And that was Larry Kramer's genius. And if he did nothing else in his life, he should be remembered forever for that.
He also wrote The Normal Heart, which is a fabulous play.
It's a fabulous play.
You compare the legal and social situations for gay people in New York City and San Francisco, two cities with significant gay populations since the 1950s. What have been some of the biggest differences in the way these two cities have dealt with their gay populations?
Well, the gay population was a higher percentage of the population in San Francisco, of the voting population in San Francisco, than it was in New York. So they were more powerful because San Francisco is a smaller place. Secondly, California had a long history of raffish and marginal sexual behavior that I think served the gay revolution well, because when they began their activism in San Francisco in the 1950s, actually, is when it started, the environment was more open. It had been a port city. It had a long history of widespread tolerance.
Well, New York is a port city.
Yeah, New York is a port city, but New York is a many other things city, including a heavily Catholic city, and so it was a much harder battle. The other thing that's interesting and relatively obscure is that in New York State, after Prohibition, there was a liquor authority, a state liquor authority, which made it almost impossible for there to be gay bars. Whereas in California, after Prohibition, the state did not establish a liquor authority. They just wanted to tax them. So there were always very successful gay bars in San Francisco.
And the cops were raiding gay bars until the Stonewall riots turned things around.
And they were raiding them because they had at least apparent authority as a result of this state liquor authority rule that gays were disorderly.
But is it ironic that in California we had Proposition 8, which bans gay marriage, and in New York the state legislature and the governor signed the bill, has legalized gay marriage? And in this state, although some of the Republicans who voted for the bill have put their political careers in jeopardy, they did vote for the bill.
The West has a tradition of referendums and initiatives of popular voting on issues that the East does not have. So it put the issue of same-sex marriage directly before a plebiscite of the people, which is always dangerous for the reasons we've just discussed.
You think it might be dangerous in New York State as well?
I think it's dangerous anywhere, but I think it's less dangerous now than it was 4 years ago, because the attitudes are changing so rapidly. So that's one thing. The other thing that I think is very interesting is that the California gay community was shocked and horrified by the passage of Prop 8, because they had indeed gotten accustomed to living in a pretty good environment from Harvey Milk on, and even going back before that. They had a pretty good deal out there in San Francisco, so it came as it was a long fall from a high place, as they say.
Well, you discuss the shift in the gay rights movement in the late 1970s from flamboyant radical activists to lawyers who now wear suits. Is this what you call "We're Just Like You"?
I don't think that the gay revolution could ever have made it on "We're Just Like You," because the fundamental thing that distinguishes them from the heterosexual elite is something that they cannot change, and it is a human behavior, which means that you only have two choices. You can stop it, which would mean being celibate, and or you can say it's good, but you can't say it's the same, because it's not the same.
Now, what got you interested in writing about this? Was it your experience as a lawyer?
No, actually, it was my
experience. Because this is about politics and law. This is more than about sexuality.
Right. Yes, that's right. There's very little sex in my book about the homosexual movement. What got me interested in it is philosophical, actually. I listened to Michael Sandel, the great Harvard philosopher, talk about the movement in the late 80s, right after the Supreme Court had said that sodomy would still be criminal. And he said that if the movement was going to succeed, it would have to argue that their relationships were good and loving and ask the society to respect them, not just to tolerate them. And I thought that was riveting. And I, as a philosopher, I'm very interested in claims of virtue. So I decided I would follow a movement that had to assert that gay is good and not just hold your nose and tolerate us. So I started following it after that point. And, of course, it was, the great years of the movement. So, that's my area of expertise. I write about social movements. So when the time came to start a new book, I thought it was time for me to write about this. I also saw this victory coming.
But isn't gay is good also a two-edged sword? Because many critics of any kind of homosexual rights say that that gays are out there trying to convert our kids.
But if it's good, then what's wrong with that?
Well, I think that converting anybody to something, we could say this religion is good, but that doesn't mean that we necessarily want somebody to convince our kid to convert to that religion.
Well, I don't know. I mean, children are kind of a wild card. I believe that if you think something's right, you ought to say so. And I spend my life trying to persuade people to believe the things that I think are right are right. So I think that conversion is kind of an artificial, dirty word. As to what children should be taught, it's an open society. I think children should be exposed to a wide range of ideas. And then when they get to be grown-ups, they can decide what they want.
Linda Hirschman's latest book, Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution, How a Despised Minority Pushed Back, Beat Death, Found Love, and Changed America for Everyone. It's published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, the one and only Joan Rivers talks about her latest book, I Hate Everyone, Starting With Me. By the way, if you're looking for inspiration in the kitchen, you can find recipes from some of America's favorite chefs and cooks like Lydia Bastianich, Mario Batali, Ina Garten, and Melissa Clark. It's all on our show page at WNYC.org. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also catch up with the show on Facebook and Twitter. If you're looking for a book to pick up during these long winter nights, why not read the Leonard Lopez Show Book Club's latest pick? We are reading Joyce Carol Oates' novel, The Gravedigger's Daughter, which is about a family that flees Nazi Germany and settles in upstate New York. But when tragedy strikes, the daughter sets off to find renewal, redemption, and peace. For more information, go to our show page and follow the links to our book club.